Good evening, it's 6:30. A group of Fort Campbell soldiers preparing for a potential deployment to Afghanistan are taking extra time to learn Afghan customs to help them build rapport with key leaders in villages preyed upon by insurgents. We go through the training and hear from Afghan role players and soldiers tonight on Front Page PM from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe. This is Front Page PM, bringing you the stories, events, and issues shaping our Four Rivers region. We also bring you Front Page AM Friday mornings at 8:35 and the hour-long Front Page Sunday at 9 a.m. Later in the program, we hear another journey story from our region, and we hear the history of the namesake of the Egner's Ferry Bridge. It's been another busy week in Kentucky's General Assembly. Lawmakers may have reached an agreement on regulating pseudoephedrine. Kentucky Amish might have a new option to a reflective triangle for their buggies, and support is waning for University of Pikeville's bid to become a public university. Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Kenny Colston speaks with Rick Hallett for some perspective on what's happening in Frankfort.
Well, let's start with pseudoephedrine, because there was a development today in the Senate, correct, on the pseudoephedrine bill.
That is correct. A little bit of a switcheroo. Yesterday afternoon, if you would have talked to Senator Robert Stivers, who's the primary sponsor of these pseudoephedrine issues, you would have thought that for the second year in a row, this issue was dead. But it was kind of funny that this amendment was filed that would double the dosage numbers that Stivers wanted. Stivers wanted a prescription-only method first. Then he wanted it restricted to 3.6 grams a month, which is roughly a box. I mean, maybe a little bit under, depending on what you buy, whether it's a 4-hour or 12-hour or 24-hour release. And then suddenly, you know, someone who's been working on the other side of this bill, Senator Jerry Rhodes, offers a floor amendment compromise that would double that to 7.2 grams, which is roughly two boxes, over-the-counter, monthly, no prescription. And that had enough votes to get it passed out. It was 25-11 today. There was a few senators absent because of the severe weather, but that was more than enough they needed to actually get that issue finally off the Senate floor.
So where does it go now? Does it need to be reconciled with the House version?
Well, the House hasn't started on it. This is one of the issues that they've let the Senate kind of go through first, and they were waiting to see how the Senate goes through it. House Speaker Greg Stumbo is a big fan of this measure. Actually, he wants it prescription only, and there's some other representatives who want it prescription only, but the battle hasn't really been fought in the House yet. They had a bill last year that they kind of advanced, but the focus has really been on the Senate. I would think that if the 7.2 grams could pass the state Senate, then it is probably likely to pass the House, and that's just my gut feeling. But the House and Speaker Stumbo might try to tighten it back down again to the 3.6. They might try to go back to the prescription only. It'll be interesting to see. I know they've been watching kind of from a distance to see what the Senate does to see where they can progress.
Kenny, the lawmakers heard this week from some folks that are urging the legislature to, at the very least, suspend the capital punishment in Kentucky until the law is further studied. What's going on there?
Yeah, that's also that happened in the Senate committee. I guess the Senate was kind of the where everything happened this week, or the majority of things. But the ACLU and a group of lawyers that represent the American Bar Association are kind of pushing this idea to abolish the death penalty in Kentucky. The ABA has released a report over the summer that listed a long laundry list of inconsistencies and errors that Kentucky's current capital punishment system has. We're talking about lawyers who aren't really trained. I mean, you're talking about public defenders who, you know, if you were going under the death penalty or you were up for that, you probably wouldn't hire them if you had all the money in the world. But they're usually the ones arguing the case. Juries who don't understand what it means, there's a long, long list. And so in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Gerald Neal and these supporters made their presentation about how Kentucky's system is inaccurate, how, you know, a lot of cases are overturned on appeal, and that there needs to be an immediate suspension of the death penalty and probably, you know, just get rid of it altogether. Because in the long run, when you talk about long court cases, it takes years, sometimes decades, to finally get the death conviction. And then they sit in prison for another 10 years and everything else. But it's really a drain on the entire legal system in the state.
Any chance that any action will be taken on this request?
You know, I don't think so this time. The report was an important step this summer for these advocates who want this. But, you know, the Senate committees kind of seem disinterested. I mean, they gave an hour of testimony to it, but no senators asked questions. They didn't really seem engaged to it. And, you know, usually if they're even if they are opposed to an issue, they're going to ask a lot of questions. So I think there's too many things going on this session for it to really go anywhere. But they got their first hearing in the Senate, and it's baby steps from here on out until I guess they can get their decision one way or another.
There's also been a compromise reached on the reflective triangles on the buggies driven by the Amish.
That's right. The House has passed their version of it, and the Senate passed theirs weeks ago. And so basically what the two chambers have to do now is they have to get together and figure out how many inches of reflective tape do we want to become law. The House has 200 inches on the back of the buggy. The Senate has 100 inches. They also have some requirements about putting lights or lamps on the buggies on the back and the sides, and tape goes everywhere else. Basically, supporters on both sides of the aisle are saying, listen, we just want to get this done. We're tired of reading stories about the Amish in Western Kentucky getting arrested and thrown in jail because they refuse to use these orange reflective triangles. Of course, not everybody's on board, but the majority of lawmakers seem to be. So they're going to have to hammer that out. You know, how many inches of reflective tape is enough? It doesn't seem like it's going to be a big problem. The Senate sponsor of that bill says that he's willing to work with the House. The House sponsor says he's willing to work with the Senate. It's just a matter of sitting down, meeting, and deciding what to do. Maybe 150 inches seems to be the middle ground. I don't know if they'll come to that or if they'll take one bill or another, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of disagreement.
Well, the Amish find these triangle symbols religiously objectionable, but they wouldn't have any problem with the reflective tape, I assume.
No, they do not. They actually testified, I think, in the House committee and said that they wouldn't have a problem with it. And they spoke with Senator Ken Winters from Murray, who's the sponsor in the state Senate. And he says that they don't have a problem with it, but there's something about the triangle that just really rubs them the wrong way, and they refuse to use it.
And debate continues in Frankfort over the effort to have the University of Pikeville made part of the state university system. Where are we on that?
Kind of in a stalling system right now. Morehead State President Wayne Andrews made his presentation from the House Education Committee earlier this week. He argued that bringing UPike into the state system is not necessarily needed, that his university and EKU and a lot of the community colleges down there have enough of a collaboration that things are going to get better, just give it time. Of course, that's not something that House Speaker Greg Stumbo and others wanted to hear. So, you know, they're at a stalling point now, and I think there's probably going to be some compromises. There's some talk of some compromises on this bill. None of them have come out, but apparently the Council on Post-Secondary Education is acting as an intermediary to this, and they're going to try to figure something out. But I don't think any of those compromises would bring UPike into the state system. So that's probably bringing that school in the state system this legislative session is probably all but dead. But that doesn't mean the issue is dead for future sessions.
Kenny Colston covers the state capitol for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You hear Kenny's reports daily during WKMS Newscast, and you can find his online stories at news.wkms.org. As severe weather struck our region this week, many of you might have had weather radios alerting you of warnings to your county, or the loud outdoor sirens you might be used to. This week, though, as a tornado warning was issued for Northern Callaway County, residents in the storm's path heard no outdoor sirens, because there aren't any. WKMS's Shelley Baskin speaks with Callaway County Emergency Management Director Bill Call to find out why.
So, Bill, as I understand it, the emergency weather sirens in Callaway County are only located in the urban areas, right?
Right. The only sirens we have in Callaway County are in the city of Murray, where there are four, and then there's one in the city of Hazel, and then there's several units on campus at Murray State. Those are actually speaker systems, although they can sound like a siren as well.
And why are these sirens put there instead of spreading them out throughout the urban and rural areas?
It's economic. You're looking at areas that are very widespread, far apart. Housing density is very low. So in order to cover the county with sirens would require a great number of sirens. And sirens are expensive. They're $10,000 to $15,000, I think, each, plus installation. So there's a lot of money to put a siren in. And then you've got to have an electric meter at each one and so forth. We did try, I think 2 years ago, a grant was written to FEMA, I think, to see if we could get a grant money for installation of sirens at the county fire stations, which are located in some of the little bit more population groupings, you know, the little communities in the county. But that grant was not funded. So presently we have no siren systems outside the cities.
And is there some sort of calculation that's done to determine how cost-effective it is to install a siren?
Yes, you generally want to place them where you'll get the most usefulness for each one, so you look for population centers. Another factor that goes into it is you want those located where the most vulnerable housing would be. So particularly, say, around trailer parks or groupings of trailers, because they're the most hazardous residences during a windstorm, would be where you'd place siren towers. So one of the city sirens, for example, is located just north of town near the Riviera Courts area, because we consider that a riskier area. Those folks definitely need to be able to hear the sirens.
Is the situation with the sirens likely to remain the same, or is there a chance that these rural areas could get sirens soon?
Right now, grants are fewer and far between than they used to be, so I don't anticipate we'd have any luck right now if we applied for grant funding, and with them being so expensive, there's not much way we could afford to do it out of our general revenues. What we suggest instead is, for now, is that homeowners should have a weather radio. Those are, in many ways, more valuable than a siren anyway. All a siren can do is to tell you that there's something going on, you need to go inside and turn on a radio or TV and see if you can learn from the news what it is you're instructed to be cautious of. Siren doesn't convey much information at all. Whether a weather radio can not only wake you up or let you hear that there's something going on, it can give you instruction as to what's happening and what to do. And they're not very expensive, so that's really what we urge folks to do.
Shelley Baskin spoke with Callaway County Emergency Management Director Bill Call. Next on Front Page PM, our local journey story installment, and we go to Fort Campbell to witness soldiers training to develop relationships with Afghan leaders. This is Front Page PM from WKMS News. This is Front Page PM from WKMS News. A traveling exhibition from the Smithsonian Institution called Journey Stories is at Murray State's Rather West Kentucky Museum through March 10th. To mark the event, we ask our listeners for their journey stories, and we received this one describing the forced exodus of residents of Land Between the Lakes.
My name is Donnie Holland. I live in Cadiz, Kentucky. I have been a lifelong resident of Trigg County and was an up-close witness to the taking of the land for Land Between the Lakes. My family settled between the rivers in the 1790s and left in July 1968. My grandparents on each side of the family lost their homes twice to government projects. I was attending Murray State and still living with my parents when our home was taken by force, bulldozed, and buried. My grandparents' aunts, uncles, and cousins' homes were all taken. Pits were bulldozed near the homes and all the outbuildings, and all signs of humanity pushed into the holes and buried as if they had never existed. The church my great-grandfather helped found was buried in a pit. I watched as the entire picturesque and historic town of Golden Pond was bulldozed to the ground and buried. Our next-door neighbors, elderly folks, were physically removed from their home by federal marshals. This was a common occurrence of the time. And I recall a surreal experience near the end as I was doing my homework. I heard very loud engines coming from up the road that crossed through our farm. It was one of our neighbors' homes loaded on a large trailer being moved laboriously and cautiously to a barge on Lake Barkley to be transported to a new location near Cadiz. The event that I'm talking about here is under discussion is not about the taking of the land for Lake Barkley, Kentucky Lake, or the 100,000 acres already owned by the government for a wildlife refuge, primarily in the north end of Between the Rivers. This is about the 75,000 acres in families' hands that had nothing to do with the gigantic projects that I just mentioned, but just simply desired by the TVA and others in government that had some warped notions about, well, I don't think anyone today can explain the thought process behind this boondoggle of 40 years ago. Nearly 5,000 people lost their homes to this modern-day atrocity, I will call it. Practically all were financially injured as well by this atrocity. As land prices around the area skyrocketed to take advantage of this large exodus, and the people of Between the Rivers were stripped of their right to a jury trial over the price of their land by Congress. Resistance was strong. Leaders took the battle to Congress. Others took to a degree of physical resistance. The first settlers' homes were burned, the TVA offices attacked with high-powered rifles, and so forth, as was amply reported by the press at that time. In the end, it has been a disaster for the area. The governor at the time, a huge supporter of taking all the land by force, was quoted, and I heard him say personally, that in effect, if we can take all the land between the lakes, we can create a recreation area so powerful that it will create a Gatlinburg at Canton running toward Cadiz and another Gatlinburg at Aurora. 44 years later and counting, nothing, literally nothing new has been spawned by the LBL at Canton, and Aurora is economically more depressed than it was before. Too much land and too many people were taken out of the equation for the region to recover from, even after this amount of time. We try to make the best of the situation now. We exaggerate the number of tourists that it attracts, hoping to make it appear more desirable and beneficial to the economy. But the cold, hard facts lead to a lesson learned, hopefully. The lesson is there must always be processes in place to control government excesses like this. This was government totally out of control, at its worst, and misguided. It is said this could not happen today, that eminent domain powers have been reined in and there are better controls. That is probably true. However, it is not necessarily written down anyplace. Although this story is getting age on it now, this very appropriate recording of these unfortunate events for the Smithsonian event, KET, and other long-term historical institutions should keep these lessons learned fresh.
Donnie Holland of Cadiz added his journey story for the WKMS series highlighting a Smithsonian Institution traveling exhibit called Journey Stories, which is at Rather West Kentucky Museum, 16th and University Drive on campus at Murray State through March 10th. Hours are 8:30 to 4, Monday through Friday, and 10 to 1 on Saturday. When the cargo ship, the Delta Mariner, collided with the Egnors Ferry Bridge this past January, news reports of the incident made headlines around the world. What those reports didn't contain was how the bridge got its name. As it happens, there was an actual ferry at the site, without which we'd know the modern-day crossing simply as the U.S. 68 Kentucky 80 Bridge. Casey Northcutt took a look into the history of the ferry, its tough-hewn owner, and the 31 variations of the name Egner, and brings us this story.
The Egner's Ferry Bridge has spanned the Tennessee River since 1932, but the ferry from which it acquired its name opened in the 1800s under the ownership of a calloused man named Milton. Philip Egner, more commonly known as Dean, traced his ancestry to the ferry owner. Dean said Milton ran the ferry from the 1840s until 1878, when he sold the business to one or two of his children. Dean said he knew little about the man other than Milton's business endeavors and his reputation.
Milton, they say, was a very rough and tough individual, which probably most people in that era and that day were. People coming west into a new territory.
This rough man operated one of the main modes of transportation across the Tennessee River, and over the years his business grew. Dean said Milton Egner operated his first ferry with oars, but later upgraded and powered the boat with a blind mule. He hitched the mule to a type of propeller called a sweep pole. The mule would walk in circles around the pole, moving the ferry. Eventually, Milton replaced the mule with a steam engine, steadily improving his equipment. Yet Egner says Milton dabbled in more than just ferry work.
Milton also was, I guess you might call, an entrepreneur. He had a grist mill that ground corn on a steamboat. He operated a stagecoach and a freight line between Hopkinsville, Kentucky, through Murray, and Columbus, Kentucky. He also operated a general merchandise store at the ferry site.
When the Civil War invaded the region, the established businessman sympathized with the Confederates. According to Dean, soldiers' bodies sometimes floated down the river, bumping up against Milton's ferry. If the corpses wore Yankee uniforms, he would simply push them away from his boat and let the current dispose of them. However, if a body belonged to the Confederate Army, Milton treated it differently.
He would actually get the body out of the river, and if there was some kind of ID, he would try to find relatives if they were local. If not, then he would bury them off the shore there. And somebody related to me that there might be a cemetery nearby up the hill, that's where they buried some of the soldiers.
During that same time period, chance began to play with the spelling of Egner's Ferry. The Kentucky Transportation Cabinet's Keith Todd recently researched the ferry's history and discovered that Confederate General Lloyd Tillman issued some sort of cable indicating that Union officers were crossing Egner's Ferry and traveling into the Murray area. Tillman got creative with the spelling of Milton Egner's name.
When he sent out that communication, he put two G's in it. And so from that time forward, it was Egner's with two G's, because that was one of the first really written references to that location.
Time progressed, and Milton sold the business to his daughter, who then closed the ferry when the bridge opened and the family name passed to it. After that, the spelling continued to evolve. Keith Todd said the Transportation Cabinet and the Coast Guard both possessed different official spellings for the structure, the former with an S and the latter without. He also said he circulated a new spelling when he accidentally put an apostrophe before the S in Egner's in press releases he issued the night of the Delta Mariner accident.
That is the way it was printed literally all over the world. It was on news media outlets in Australia. Lloyd's of London had a report on it up on their website, and of course had the apostrophe in it. Fox News, CNN, all of those outlets, it all had the apostrophe in it because that was the very first thing that I sent out, and it kind of stuck.
But spelled with an S, an apostrophe, or two G's, Egner's Ferry is a name that will stick around for a while. The original ferry was a major mode of transportation in the 1800s, and now that the bridge lies out of order, the Transportation Cabinet might reinstate another ferry while construction crews repair the bridge. Therefore, the name Egner's Ferry could once again refer to an actual ferry. For WKMS News, I'm Casey Northcutt.
At Fort Campbell, troops from the 327th Infantry Regiment, 1st Brigade Combat Team, are in intensive training for a potential deployment to Afghanistan this winter. Among their training missions is what's called a soldier-leader engagement, where the soldiers practice building relationships with the people in that country. I spent the day at Fort Campbell and learned that relationship building there isn't as easy as a smile and a handshake. A group of six Afghan men dressed in traditional long flowing garments play cards and listen to music from a small boombox while they await their orders for a planned engagement training, or SLE. Role player Qadus Khan, who plays the village elder, lays out the basic reason for the training. His son, Hamid, interprets.
When you know how to talk to an elder, as he says, that's where relationships start. If you know the culture of the country, if you know how to come into a house, how to sit down, how to shake someone's hand, how to eat, how to do everything in a way where it's towards our culture would be much better than what it is when they go walking there first.
The Army is keenly interested in relationships. 1st Brigade Commander Colonel J.P. McGee says soldiers, now with longer time between deployments, are focusing more on culture and language training.
If you have the skills required to establish good working relations with your partners, you're going to be more effective when you actually go down and do it. And a lot of those skills are something that need to be practiced because the Afghan culture is different.
Today is when soldiers, many of them for the first time, learn some of these skills.
He's really upset with the nighttime raids.
Captain Mark Searles has been deployed to Afghanistan before, but this is his first SLE training. He's huddled in a circle with his team, prepping them with intelligence before meeting with the Afghan role players.
Schooled up on our thought process and how we do business as far as...
The scenario is an ongoing blood feud between two tribes within the village, with one facilitating insurgent activity. The soldiers are now on the scene after a bout of IED explosions that have left two children dead. Captain Searles, another soldier, and his interpreter enter a gate. They walk past two goats in the front yard of a makeshift shelter and meet the village elder, the mayor, and the village police chief.
Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
Caduce, the elder, reaches out to greet Captain Searles with two hands, and the captain reciprocates with only one, which is his first mistake. He then makes his second mistake without even a word. He failed to ask permission to enter the tent with his boots on. He then recovers well by introducing his partner and interpreter. They exchange niceties with the Afghans, but 5 minutes into the conversation, Captain Searles makes another mistake.
Listen, I know you invited us here to come to your village because you wanted to speak about some issues.
He cuts to the chase when the elder still wants to continue small talk. The exercise continues for around an hour, and Captain Searles makes another few more minor mistakes when telling the elder he could help him with a project. But Searles thinks he performed well.
Overall, I wouldn't say too bad. I think there's always those cultural differences of, hey, you made a promise. Well, no, I really didn't. But that's just the finer things between the two cultures.
His interpreter, Hamid, agrees, but he gives Searles a tough suggestion. Try to take charge, but be patient.
I don't know if I've cracked the code on that yet. It's kind of talking out of both sides of your mouth, I think, because if you don't make an attempt, you could be there for 2 hours. We just don't have that kind of time. A lot of that also, I think, depends on your take on the situation. I mean, both parties had engaged in small talk, initiated by both parties. So is that enough, maybe, or not, if you want to keep talking?
Searles describes his mission as sort of a checklist, where Hamid's tip to a successful engagement and path to building rapport is much more humanistic.
You have to try to get into the heart of those people. You have to be very generous. You have to have a specific way of talking so that they can gain some trust from you. And to balance that would be to talk about your family so that they would know that you do care, which is important for those people. They want you to care.
It's a simple idea, but a challenging practice for these young soldiers. They're tasked with very complex objectives ranging from calling in an artillery strike to protecting themselves to having tea with an elder to gain intelligence. And as Colonel J.P. McGee says, these objectives won't change. Relationship building for these men is now and remains a top priority. However challenging, that's what they're there for. For WKMS News, I'm Chad Lampe. This has been Front Page PM, our regional news magazine following Marketplace at 6:30 on Fridays. You may have missed Front Page AM today, now a regular feature at 8:35 Friday mornings. So if you'd like to hear any of these or any of our stories again, you can find them online anytime at news.wkms.org. You can also catch us this Sunday morning at 9 for our hour-long Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe. Thanks for being here.